It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In 2 weeks, the University of Pittsburgh is holding a two-day conference exploring the issue of threat convergence, particularly between criminal and terrorist networks. One of the participants will be our next guest, University of Pittsburgh Associate Professor of International Affairs, Michael Kenny, who says while media attention often focuses on the young teenagers who have answered the Islamic State's call, another essential set of recruits are activists from Britain and other Western countries who are deeply committed to establishing the caliphate, both in their home countries and globally. Michael Kenny has researched the issue and joins us now to discuss how we can reach the people the Islamic State is trying to recruit. Michael Kenny, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm. And on Twitter at ESSPGH. Michael Kenny, who are these terrorist recruits from Britain and other Western countries?
Well, over the last several years, I've conducted quite a bit of field research on one particular network in question, which was originally called Al-Muhajirun, or the Immigrants. Although these guys are the network itself, are not terrorists per se, a number of their activists have continued their radicalization after they were involved with the group and later went on to commit acts of political violence, including suicide bombings in Iraq and Syria. Years ago, there was an activist who engaged in a suicide bombing in Israel. And then there's been a number of these individuals, including a couple of young men who beheaded a British soldier on the streets of London back in 2013. So the people that I've interviewed with repeatedly over the years are more on the activist side. Unfortunately, some of them end up involved in political violence. And what happened with the declaration of the caliphate back in June of 2014 was that for these guys, for these activists in Britain, the end game had been achieved. They had been working to establish the caliphate in Britain and the West and globally for almost 20 years, for 18 years at that point. Now the caliphate had been declared. So for them, it was the ultimate achievement of their objectives. And so now the time comes to make hijra, or to immigrate to the Islamic State, so you can join the cause. Not coincidentally, since the caliphate has been declared, we've seen thousands of young men and women from Western Europe, including many hundred from Britain alone, that have decided to join the cause in Iraq and Syria.
And the age range and the thumbnail profile of these individuals would be what?
Well, I mean, many of them, you see teenagers, you see many people in their 20s. You also see some older people, frankly, 30s and older. But the major profile would be a young man or woman, late teens, early 20s, somebody who is disenfranchised in British society or the countries that they're living in, somebody who might be looking for greater excitement, greater meaning in their lives, who's searching for that self of identity. And then for some of these people, the ideology ties into it as well, and they are ideologically driven.
You came face-to-face with Abu Rahin Aziz. How did it happen, and what did you make of him?
He was just kind of this typical activist that I used to see all the time in London. He was very active for the group. He would go to their protests and participate by shouting slogans, waving signs, denouncing the British government, denouncing the U.S., demonstrating in front of the U.S. Embassy, for example, and burning a replica of the American flag. On one occasion, they demonstrated in front of Royal Albert Hall and burned some replicas of the British poppies on Armistice Day, which is a major symbol in the end of World War One, huge thing in Britain and Western Europe.
So they're just trying to go out of their way to agitate.
Yeah, that's
the British and people with any kind of Western sensibility about war and our history of involvement in the world wars and other wars.
And they actually concede that this is part of our strategy of work. They try to be deliberately provocative to raise their profile in the media, so they create the impression that they are very widespread and that they have lots of support from the Muslim community. But actually, they have very little support from the wider Muslim communities inside of Britain.
But they, by doing these things that you describe, they're effectively reaching recruits, right? And some of these people are going from England to Syria, or to maybe to Turkey, and then into Syria or Iran and other countries, and you know, conducting these activities that have made headlines, you know, in the name of the caliphate.
Yes, absolutely.
So what are countries like Great Britain doing to combat this?
Well, what countries like Great Britain are doing to try and combat it is a number of things. You know, there is the military campaign over there, which has, as we all know, has mixed results. More to the point, there's the ideological side of the struggle, and it's the attempt to engage, to recognize, to concede, and engage in what some would call the battle of ideas for young hearts and minds in Western Europe, because there is an ideological basis and even a scriptural basis to the interpretation that these young men and women have. And what we need are what are sometimes called de-radicalization or counter-radicalization programs, where you have young Muslims engaging with other young Muslims to try and turn them away from their violent interpretation of the religion. It's something that's best performed by other Muslims. You can't have people like me go in, because I would have no religious credibility with these young men and women. What you need are Muslims themselves who live in the West, respect, you know, democratic norms and values, and these are part of their identity. And they're very upset with what they see groups like ISIS and al-Muhajirun doing. And they reject that interpretation of their religion, and they want to turn people away. So in Britain, there are a number of programs, the Channel Program, there's other groups like West London Impact, there's an organization called Fight and Management. And some of these programs, what makes them so interesting, feature former extremists, people that when they were younger were caught up in that worldview, were caught up in that lifestyle. And so they can really speak to the mindset and incorporate the lingo and the language of these young men and women who are now gravitating in that direction.
And is what Great Britain is doing to counteract this, is it working? Is it effective?
The honest answer, Paul, is we don't really know. I mean, many of these programs are new. They don't have the proper amount of resources that they need. There are individual success stories that we can point to, individuals that have been turned away. Unfortunately, there are also individuals like the people that I know from my research. I know people from al-Muhajirun who participated in these de-radicalization programs, had no impact on them whatsoever. They continued to do their thing.
What was it like for you to bump around with these people?
Well, I mean, they want to engage. They want to engage. I've never been dishonest about who I am or what I'm trying to do. So with me, I've known these guys since 2007. Okay, so I've developed a relationship with them over time. So there is a measure of trust, for lack of a better word. They know who I am. They know that I haven't tried to burn them. And so there is a measure of trust there. But the other side of it is, of course, they want to convert me to their cause, to bring me over. That would be seen as a great coup for them. And also, they see me as somebody who can help get the word out for them, you know, to so there's a number of things going on.
But they're okay with you, with your honest assessments of who they are and what they're doing. They're not.
Yeah, they are. I mean, and I'd. they've seen writings of mine where I talk about, you know, the violent connections. And they, you know, I've had conversations with people where they're, and I've been like, well, are you okay with that? Not that I need their approval. I would never need their approval. But, and they've been like, yeah, I mean, that's how we are. I mean, that they're pretty open about who they are and what they're trying to achieve. And a number of them have been implicated in what are sometimes called terrorism-related offenses. We do have to be careful when we use terms like that, because sometimes what are called terrorism-related offenses are actually like free speech offenses, like they were at a protest and they went too far, so they were prosecuted for terrorism fundraising when they made remarks like support the Mujahideen in Iraq, you know. And so based on comments like that, they were prosecuted and convicted of terrorism fundraising. So you have to be careful, and there's a lot of that going on. But in addition to that, you do have a small number of people from these networks who really did engage in violence.
We're talking with University of Pittsburgh Associate Professor of International Affairs Michael Kenney, who has written about and researched extensively, gone to England and traveled in Europe, looking at who is being targeted by terrorist groups, who is being recruited, and what some of those who have gotten involved with these groups, with radical organizations, are doing and saying about what they're doing. Again, Michael Kenney with us, and you can ask a question or make a comment to him by calling 412-246-2002 in the minutes that we have remaining. You follow the comings and goings of Abu Rahim Aziz, whom you profiled in a recent story that you did for the Post Gazette. And what did you learn when Aziz, he kind of fits the profile of what you're talking about in terms of the people that we sometimes overlook, you know, when in all of the screaming headlines about, you know, our young teenagers are going over to join the terrorists. So what did you learn when Aziz fled Britain for Syria? There's an interesting story there.
Yeah, there is an interesting story, which is that British counterterrorism policy and British authorities, in trying to deal with this very real problem of having activists on their street that are really promoting this ideology, when the police crack down on these groups and they arrest them and they proceed to prosecute them for different crimes, it sometimes has the unintended effect of further pushing these guys into the arms of groups that actually engage in physical violence. And that's exactly what happened to Abu Rahim Aziz. Abu Rahim Aziz was just this kid from Luton who got caught up in this radical politics years ago, was a hardcore activist, but hadn't been involved in violence. He was arrested for committing crimes, so authorities have to prosecute that. But while he was on bail for crime, for, you know, his criminal involvement, he decided, you know what, I can't engage in my activism anymore here in Britain. I'm about to be convicted. I'm going to leave.
And well, it's one way of avoiding jail.
And one way of avoiding jail, as they've told me in interviews, is to leave. And this was right around the time that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was declaring the caliphate. And so where better place to go than the Khilafah, the caliphate? And so that's exactly what he did. And that's what other people from the group did as well. Mirza Tariq Ali, several months later, it's the same thing. He was actually arrested with Abu Rahim Aziz at the same events. He also decided, you know what, I'm leaving. And then there was a set of arrests in September 2014 where British authorities rounded up the leadership of the whole group. One of those guys was released on bail. The police never got his passport. So he took his passport, he took his young family, his wife, his kids, and he left. And he's now in Syria, in Raqqa, and he's become an ideologue, and it is believed to be a fighter for the Islamic State.
Well, what you know, if the British are erring or making an error by, you know, pouncing on these guys, you know, before they do anything serious, right? You know, if they don't do that, do you then end up with the guy on the train in France who's got the AK-47, you know, because he was profiled. He was on a list of, but you know, they get to the point where they can't keep tracking this guy anymore because he hasn't done anything yet. But then, you know, there he is on the train with the, you know, the clips and the AK-47 and the handgun and the knife and the whole bit. So, you know, what are governments supposed to do based on what you've looked into, Michael?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I do not want to suggest that I have the magic wand to wave over this problem and solve the ills. I don't. Okay. And what you've put your finger on, Paul, is exactly the challenge. You know, I do believe that when people break the law in Britain and France and the U.S., absolutely, they should be arrested for breaking the law and they should be prosecuted. And that has happened in the case of Al-Muhajirun activists who they broke the law and they were rightly arrested and prosecuted. And some of them are now in jail. Where I think that sometimes the policy misses the boat a little bit is in addressing the youngsters that now, as we speak, are being recruited into the group. Okay. I was just there in July. Okay. And I can tell you that in spite of the recent arrests and people being in jail and all that, this group is still active and they're still recruiting young people. I was running because I hang out with them, right? So I was seeing people that I had never seen on previous trips, young people, right? And this is something that has happened over and over and over again. That's where the policy is falling short. You know, how do we address that problem where we have these older, experienced activists who are still able to reach out and draw these younger kids into their networks? I think British authorities would tell you, would concede that this is an issue that they've been struggling to deal with.
And the last thing I want to touch on is that you say that there is good news, which we're all certainly looking for in this situation. And it is that the dogmatic medieval vision of Islam favored by such extremists is rejected by the vast majority of Muslims today. So if we can win the war of ideas against groups like the Islamic State, how do we do that so that the people that talk to you who are saying, you know, I'm committed to this. This is how we are seeking justice. We can't understand it, nor should we, because it's violent. It makes no sense. It's a dogma that really has no logical counter argument. So how do you reason with these people, and how do we take advantage of the fact that the majority of the Muslims in the world today are opposed to what's going on, the violence that's happening?
It's critically important. We have to take advantage of the fact that this worldview that the extremists have is by definition extreme, and that the vast majority of Muslims do not support this, and they're frankly aghast at the violence they see being carried out in what is purported to be the name of their religion. So we have to use those resources. Muslims are going to be the most effective people that can counter the ideology because they know the religion, they know the scripture, okay? And so they can counter arguments where the extremists basically cherry-pick different verses from the Quran or the Hadith, which are the stories of what the Prophet said and did and passed down. It's now codified in collections. They can counter that by saying, well, that's true. The Prophet is reported to have said that. But you know what? That's a weak Hadith. You know, that Hadith has been called into question by a number of scholars. You see? Or they can say, Yeah, that's true. What you just cited, that is a verse from the Quran. But you know what? That verse was later abrogated by another set of verses that took a different interpretation of that. Or you know what? You're cherry-picking different verses here, and you're not putting things in the proper historical context of the time. Muslims have this knowledge, and they're going to be more effective in countering the arguments that are made by the people that I was coming across in my research.
We've been talking with Michael Kenney, who is an associate professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, and again, the two-day conference exploring the issue of threat convergence, particularly between criminal and terrorist networks, is happening in 2 weeks on the Pitt campus. Michael Kenney, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Paul.
Coming up, the Steelers signed quarterback Michael Vick, and there's already a backlash. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.